is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty reporting. President Donald Trump has promised quick, decisive action following a suspected chemical weapons attack in Syria that killed at least 60 and affected hundreds more. Mr. Trump described the late Saturday attack on the rebel-held town of Douma as heinous.
It was an atrocious attack. It was horrible. You don't see things like that, as bad as the news is around the world. You just don't see those images. We are studying that situation extremely closely. We are meeting with our military and everybody else, and we'll be making some major decisions over the next 24 to 48 hours.
Mr. Trump met his national security team at the White House into the evening. There is no conclusive evidence the attack was carried out by Syria. Rupert Colville is spokesman for the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights.
It's very hard to verify exactly what's happened in Douma. These are extremely grave allegations of yet another devastating chemical attack, but it's really impossible to verify anything at this point, unfortunately.
Britain and the U.S. said the attack bore the hallmarks of previous chemical weapons attacks carried out by the Syrian regime, but both Damascus and Russia deny involvement. Mr. Trump said it would be very tough on Moscow if it bore any responsibility. Russia's UN ambassador Vasily Nebenzia warned any use of armed force could lead to what he called grave repercussions. U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis said the Kremlin has fallen short of its obligations to ensure Syria abandoned all its chemical weapons. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari has confirmed his intention to run for re-election next year. The 75-year-old, despite bouts of ill health, said he stands ready to run in February's ballot on the ticket of his All-Progressive Congress Party. Mr. Buhari defeated his predecessor Goodluck Jonathan in 2015, the first opposition candidate to do that at the ballot box. This is VOA News. President Trump said Monday he expects a proposed meeting with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un to take place within the next 2 months.
We've been in touch with North Korea. We'll be meeting with them sometime in May or early June, and I think there'll be great respect paid by both parties, and hopefully we'll be able to make a deal on the denuking of North Korea.
His comments came after U.S. officials confirmed the North Korean leader is willing to discuss the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. In a Tuesday speech, Chinese President Xi Jinping promised to open China's economy, lower import duties, increase foreign ownership, and open its financial sector. His comments came a day after President Trump voiced optimism a trade war with China can be averted. Mr. Trump said he doesn't blame China for the current tensions.
And I don't blame China. I blame the people running our country. I blame presidents. I blame representatives. I blame negotiators. We should have been able to do what they did. We didn't do it. They did. And it's the most lopsided set of trade rules, regulations that anybody's ever seen.
Mr. Trump, vowing to protect intellectual property and reduce the trade imbalance, has proposed $50 billion in trade tariffs on Chinese imports and threatened even more. China has vowed to retaliate. South Africa's highest court has rejected a request for appeal against the 13-year prison term of Paralympic gold medalist Oscar Pistorius for the murder of his girlfriend, Reeva Steenkamp, in 2013. Pistorius's prison term was lengthened last November. The governors of three U.S. border states have pledged 1,600 National Guard troops to help maintain border security, following a call for 2,000 to 4,000 troops by President Trump last week to help the Border Patrol contain the flow of illicit drugs and illegal immigrants. Doug Ducey is the governor of Arizona.
We had a 200% increase in traffic across the border. The people that are suffering the drug overdoses, oftentimes these products are coming over the border and through our state.
Meanwhile, Mexico said it's reviewing all forms of cooperation with Washington, partly in response to the National Guard deployment and trade tensions with Washington. Colombia has arrested a former senior rebel peace negotiator who faces extradition on drug charges to the U.S. Sixius Hernandez was arrested in the capital, Bogota, on charges he conspired to smuggle several tons of cocaine into the U.S., where he was indicted by a grand jury last week. The government reached a landmark peace deal with the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia in 2016. All three major U.S. stock indices rose in Monday trading as a softer tone from the U.S. on a pending trade war eased with some investor concerns. The benchmark Dow Jones Index gained nearly 50 points to close at 23,979. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, April 10th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari will seek re-election in 2019.
The chances are excellent because I think the president and our party did want it. They show a clear understanding of the key problems that the country faces: problem of insecurity, problem of corruption, and the economy.
Galba Shehu is the spokesman for President Buhari of Nigeria. Zimbabwe invites 46 countries to observe this year's election. Liberia's leading newspaper resumes publication today, Tuesday, after it was shut down yesterday and the entire staff arrested. And South Sudan's government react to the formation of yet another rebel group.
The formation of this new rebel group by the former chief of general staff of the SPLF forces, General Paul Malong, is not new and it's not a strain.
Michael Makui is South Sudan's information minister. African migrants are in limbo after Israel zigzags on their deportation. And we'll take a look at transit centers in Niger to help African migrants. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari has announced he will seek re-election in 2019. This follows a meeting of the Executive Committee of the ruling All Progressives Congress Party, APC. Mr. Buhari made the announcement on his Twitter account. It is, however, not clear if the president will face any challenge from within the APC. Critics say President Buhari's undisclosed sickness, which has forced him to seek medical attention abroad, is one demonstration why he may be medically unfit to handle the stress associated with running the affairs of the country. Presidential spokesman Garba Shehu tells viewers Peter Clotty that President Buhari will win the February 16, 2019 presidential vote.
The president made his intention known to the party executive committee meeting. He said he will seek the party support for the next year's general election for a second term.
Are there indications that he could have an internal challenge for the position of flag bearer of the APC, despite the fact that he's the sitting president?
The party's constitution is in line with the constitution of the country. Citizens, all of the 118 million citizens of Nigeria, if they meet their requirement for the office, they can participate.
Some people are saying that the president should run by popular request. Others are saying, so far, he has not shown that he is medically fit to seek re-election and should go home and rest. What do you say to that?
I think that whoever is watchful of what the president is doing lately and his state of health, the outlook of it and all of that, I would venture to say that the president looks healthier today than he did when he came into the office. So he's good enough to continue.
So when do we expect him to officially present his papers to stand for the APC in next year's election?
The Independent National Electoral Commission has laid out a timetable, and the party congress for nominations was set in August this year and the end in October. So within that period, the president will be conversing with the party members and seeking their support. So, but formally at the convention, that will be sometime between the middle of August and October.
So realistically, what do you think Mr. President's chances are, the prospect of winning next year's election are?
Well, the chances are excellent because I think the president and our party did want it. They show a clear understanding of the key problems that the country faces: problem of insecurity, which was exacerbated by Boko Haram terrorism, problem of corruption, and the economy, which has been run down by the government that we succeeded. The president is doing excellently well with the war against corruption. Boko Haram is just a finishing job. That is, we are just cleaning up the place. On corruption, you can see that we are doing so good a job at home that we see it on the continent. The African Union has appointed him as the champion of anti-corruption on the continent this year. And the economy has been pulled out of recession. We have blocked the leakages and we are rebuilding. And this certainly is not the time when things are
It appears Boko Haram, despite the gains made by the Nigerian military is resurging after the Dapchigel scenario, after attacking some military installations and all that. How is the fight against terrorism, since Boko Haram seemed to be in the news recently following the negotiations to release some of the Dapchigels?
Well, I don't want to use the word impugnable. More than 90% of Boko Haram has been dealt with. They had a territory, an Islamic Republic, they had carved out of Nigerian territory. They had a flag of their own and a system of subjection. All that has been done. What is left is a finishing job. I think that what is going on with Boko Haram and all of these criminal elements should be taken together as acts of criminality. It's very difficult to say there is one country anywhere in the world where there is no criminal activity. But the government is doing the most and the best anybody can do in the circumstance. And this shall come to pass.
Garba Shehu, spokesman for Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotty from the capital, Abuja. The Zimbabwe government has invited 46 countries, including the United States, as well as international bodies such as the European Union, to observe this year's general election. As Sebastian Mofu reports from Harare, this will be the first time since 2002 that Western countries will observe an election in Zimbabwe.
The African Union, the Southern African Development Community, the Common Market for Eastern and Southern Africa, the European Union and the Commonwealth are some of the international bodies. Zimbabwe's Minister of Foreign Affairs said we are among those invited to observe the country's general election expected in July or August of this year. This will be the first time since 2002 that countries from the West, such as the US and Canada, will observe Zimbabwe's elections. Tabita Kumalo, the spokeswoman for the Movement for Democratic Change, comments on this development.
Observing the elections, to us, it means at least there will be people who are outside Zimbabwe who will monitor our election is a plus. But what is critical is they then have to look at our areas of concern.
Under Robert Mugabe's reign, which ended following his resignation after giving in to military-led pressure, no observers from the West were allowed in Zimbabwe. That had been the case since 2002 when he deported some of them after they accused his government of election rigging. Immediately, most Western countries imposed smart sanctions on Zimbabwe's leadership. President Emmerson Mnangagwa, who came to power last November, has promised free, fair, and credible elections. Tabita Kumalo, the spokeswoman for Zimbabwe's main opposition party, the MDC, says the country's elections body, better known as ZEC, has a lot to do to ensure this year's elections are credible.
ZEC is full of soldiers, and the role is going to rig the election. And the other issue is the printing of the ballot papers. Which company is going to print them? Where are we getting the paper from? We need to audit the voters, and then we all agree that everything that we think should be there is there. And at the same time, the issue of collection of voter slip is raising a lot of eyebrows.
Lately, some members of the ruling ZANU-PF party have been asking for serial numbers of voters' registration slips. Opposition parties in Zimbabwe say this is part of intimidation, which they have been complaining about during Mugabe's 30-year rule. Since taking the reins last November, Mugabe's former deputy, President Emmerson Mnangagwa, has promised 2018 elections to be free, fair, and credible. And now he has fulfilled one of his promises to allow Western governments and organizations to send election observers. It remains to be seen if he will give in to more demands from the opposition. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, April 10th. And please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 15 minutes past the hour. The editor of Front Page Africa, Liberia's leading online and print newspaper, says President George Weah's government was definitely behind Monday's shutdown of the paper and the arrest of its entire staff. But Rodney Sears says the government action will not keep the paper from doing its investigative reporting. In a press statement on Monday, Minister of Information Eugene Nnabuye said the government did not play a role in the closure of Front Page Africa and the arrest of its staff. Instead, Nnabuye said the shutdown and arrests were the result of a $350,000 lawsuit brought against the Front Page Africa by two private citizens concerning a land announcement published in Front Page Africa and other Liberian newspapers. But editor Sears says the shutdown is all a part of a campaign by some supporters of President Weah to target his paper for not writing, quote, positive stories about the government.
The question we want to know is how and why did they arrest the ordinary employees at the paper? And the 15th of April, the date that's stipulated by the court, had not even arrived. We're not given time to appear in court. And they went ahead and arrested our staff today. It's very shocking. And it just builds up to the momentum that's been building lately with the threats we've been receiving on social media, the issue with the city corporation, all these things adding up. It's like, there's just too many coincidences, and we feel strongly that some heavy hands in the government behind this thing.
I'm sure you have seen the Minister of Information, Eugene Nnabuye, has put out a press statement saying that the closure of your newspaper and the arrest of your journalists was not the act of the Liberian government.
Well, James, it's difficult to decipher because the plaintiff, the guy who filed the suit, Mr. Henry Morgan, in 2011 ran on the Congress for Democratic Change ticket in Bowman County, electoral district number 2. So he's a member of the ruling party. As you know, there are a lot of overzealous people in this country who want to either please the president or get in the good books of the president. And the manner in which it happened, I mean, we were not even given a chance to go to court. And he shut the paper down without even giving us a chance to appear in front of the judge. So that makes it look like it's very, very, very suspicious. Because I think the government, although they said they're not part of it, but there's just too many things happening lately to suggest that they're targeting our people.
So, Rodney, tell me, what is the purpose of this $350,000 lawsuit that was brought against you by this Mr. Henry A.K. Morgan and Moses T. Kona of Monrovia? What is that?
Well, both of these people are members of the CDC, James. In Liberia, before you survey a land, you should have a publication in the newspapers. And so this land issue was published in four newspapers, the Daily Observer, the New Democrat, the Inquirer, and the Front Page Africa. So why are they taking on Front Page Africa alone to the extent that you put a date on the summons, but you arrest before the date even arrives? That is where I think they made a mistake, and that is where the smoking gun in this case comes up, James. So the minister might be saying one thing, but then he has not been able to explain why the court decided to arrest the staff long before the date that was on the summons for arrest.
Let me say that I spoke with the Minister of Information, Eugene Nnabuye, and he indicated that the government has not attacked the press. In fact, he said the government is committed to a free press in Liberia.
It's one thing to say, James, but it's another thing to have it happen under your watch. In less than a week, this paper has been through 3, 4, maybe 5 different incidents from the same government. And we all know in Africa how it works. You get some private person to go after a paper and make it look like the government hands are not in it. So we've been there before. We've been down this road before. I just think it's unfair to the country to just keep attacking one newspaper.
So what happens next now? Does Front Page have a lawyer? And when do you think your paper can begin publishing again?
We should be on the newsstand on Tuesday this morning because yesterday our lawyer was able to file a bond, which I think is going to be effective today.
Rodney Sears, the editor of Front Page Africa, Liberia's leading online and print newspaper. He was speaking with me from New York City. The South Sudan government says the former chief of general staff of the country's army, General Paul Malong Awan, is a corrupt person who destroyed the military by diverting the army's resources for his personal gain. This comes after General Malong announced on Monday that he had formed a rebel group, the South Sudan United Front, to fight against what he called systemic corruption in South Sudan. Malong also accused President Salva Kiir of obstructing the implementation of the 2015 peace deal. But Information Minister Michael McQuay says General Malong forms his rebel group as a way for him to climb back into power.
The formation of this new rebel group by the former chief of general staff of the SPLF forces, General Paul Malong, is not new and it's not strange. It's not strange because he decided to rebel after his relief from his position as the chief of general staff, which means that he only rebelled because he wants a position. Had he not been relieved, he would have definitely not rebelled. So whatever rebellion, whatever movement he is establishing it with the hope that it will take him to power and make him the president or whatever in the government.
General Malong saying that he starts his rebel group to fight what he called systemic corruption and arrest what he called a carnage. That means he's telling your government that your government is corrupt.
Well, he's saying that he's corrupt, but he's at the top of the list of the corrupt people in the Republic of South Sudan. He has actually destroyed the army systematically by deviating all the resources of the army to his own interests. And he's at the top of the corruption, and this is one of the reasons which led to his removal. So I'm surprised that he turns around today to charge the government of corruption and charge him of nepotism and charge him of all atrocities. This is definitely a question of self-interest, and it has nothing to do with the public interest.
But Mr. Minister, he has accused President Salva Kiir of repeatedly obstructing the implementation of the 2015 peace deal. A day ago, I spoke with you where we talk about the government might hold election because the rebels are not sincere in their negotiation.
One of the reasons we led to his removal is that he actually obstructed the smooth implementation of the agreement, including violations in terms of the cessation of hostilities and the permanent ceasefire. So this is one of the reasons we led to his removal. Now, because he's outside, he turns around and says that he's fighting the government because of peace. What I'm saying is that let him join the peace process, and then we will go and meet him with the other rebel groups and opposition groups without subjecting the lives of the people of South Sudan to another danger. But if General Malong doesn't want to approach the resolution of the problems of South Sudan in a peaceful way and he has decided to follow the way of violence to remove the government, then government is ready to give him a real hot pursuit and teach him a lesson.
Minister, again, the next phase of the revitalization forum is coming up on the 26th. What should the people of South Sudan expect?
We are ready to go for the revitalization, and we are going with an open heart, we are going with an open mind, hoping that the opposition groups, irrespective of their categories, that they will come negotiate in good faith. I'm happy to learn that they have now negotiating as one group. This is a very good divide.
Michael McQuay, South Sudan's Minister of Information, he was speaking with me from the capital, Juba. About 40,000 Africans in Israel are facing an uncertain future as Israel resumes efforts to deport them. Robert Berger reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
African migrants have been on a roller coaster ride since last week when the Israeli government did an about face. First, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced that Israel had reached a compromise with the UN Refugee Agency. Under the deal, some 16,000 Africans would be sent to Western countries, while more than 20,000 would be allowed to remain in Israel. The migrants were elated, but not for long. Netanyahu abruptly canceled the agreement the next day after his right-wing coalition partners demanded that all the Africans be deported. The government rejects claims the Africans are refugees, describing them as economic migrants and infiltrators. Most of the migrants arrived in Israel from war-torn Eritrea and Sudan during the past decade. Teklit Mikhael, a 29-year-old asylum seeker from Eritrea, says he does not know where he can work legally, he does not have a permanent place to live, and he fears being deported or thrown in jail. Some Israelis blame the migrants for rising crime and poverty in South Tel Aviv and accuse them of threatening the Jewish character of the state. So the government is trying to revive a plan to send them to a third country in Africa after Uganda backed out of a deal to take them in because it could not guarantee their safety. Israeli human rights lawyer Avigdor Feldman says the government's policy is legally and morally unacceptable. He says sending people to African countries where their lives would be in danger is a violation of international law. He adds that Israel has an ethical obligation to offer the Africans asylum because Jews were refugees during the Holocaust. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Although the number of migrants leaving Niger for Libya have dropped in recent years, the number of people coming back to Niger from Libya and Algeria is rising, says the International Organization for Migration, Monica Chirac, a spokesperson for the IOM in Niger, spoke with Ricky Stryak about the programs the organization have been implementing at transit centers to help migrants who would like to return home.
In Niger, we have 6 transit centers for migrants. We have 3 in Niamey, and 1 in Agadez, 1 in Atlit, and 1 in Dirkou. So then in Niamey, the 3 different centers are 1 for women, 1 for minors, and 1 for men and families. So then, of course, depending on the center, we have different classes. We have psychosocial activities, so we always ask the migrants what kind of activities they would be interested in, whether it's sports or music, dance. So then they were the ones that suggested the DJ classes. So this is one of the activities that we picked for the Center for Minors. Then, for example, for the Center for Women, we have classes on cooking. And then at the other center, we have classes on painting. And one of the other activities is painting the centers. So this took place in Agadez as well, and then in Arlit and Dirkou as well. So we always try to integrate their ideas and their suggestions in the activities that we schedule for them. This is a way for them to have an activity that will keep them busy and keep their minds occupied while they wait to return to their countries of origin.
How important is it to keep people, from a psychosocial standpoint, to keep people's minds focused on something else while they are in this transitory state, especially after many of them might have gone through trauma being left in the desert or coming back from Libya?
I think it's very important, but first of all, it's very important to talk about their feelings, or at least to get the opportunity to open up. A lot of them maybe don't feel the need to open up or are not ready yet. So that's why we offer them other means to express themselves. For example, drawing. A lot of them will draw maybe the car, the pickup truck that took them to Libya, or their experience in prison in Libya. So we offer them the chance to open up and really express their feelings, whether that's through activities or talking to our therapists at the centers.
In addition to being something that can help maybe psychosocially, these activities, the DJ activity can be used as a way for people to learn computer skills. Is that correct? That they could then perhaps translate into some kind of work eventually.
Exactly. And I mean, a lot of them have said that this is what they're interested in, and that potentially going back home, they could have the opportunity to work in this field. Of course, it's a training that usually lasts only for a couple of weeks because migrants have to leave. So it's not something that you can do for an extended period of time. But at least it's a start for them. So once they're back, they can see whether they could find a job in the field or, I don't know, start practicing at home and eventually take it to the next level.
Monica Chiriak is the spokesperson for the IOM in Niger. And that's it for this Tuesday, April 10th edition of Daybreak Africa. I'm James Botte in Washington.
Hello, I'm Lee Normadou, host of Health Chat. Next week on Health Chat, we will discuss some basic steps you can take to help you stay in good health when traveling. Our guest is Dr. Ken Red Cross, internal medicine specialist and concierge doctor. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The U.S. country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. Health Chat. This Tuesday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.